I'm turning this evening to the book of Proverbs, chapter 16 and verse 1. Proverbs, chapter 16, verse 1. The preparations of the heart in man and the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. And our subject will be wholehearted submission to God. Now, in our last study, We looked at a summary, briefly, by way of introduction of the book of Proverbs. I'm not going to repeat any of that this evening, but I'd like to go to another passage in Proverbs, just nine verses in this 16th chapter. And I will just remind you that from chapter 10 on, a third of the way through the book approximately, to almost the end, the book consists of very short proverbs, or, if you like, parables, because that's what they are, compressed miniature parables, pictures. And they are not just sundry exhortations, as you might think, but they develop various topics or subjects. And the way to understand these short parables in the book of Proverbs is to study them and review them in order to discern and to see where different topics begin and end. And that's not a terribly difficult thing to do. And then you find that maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 verses are all grouped together on approximately the same theme. Or at least the majority of Proverbs in any given set will be about the same thing, and that leads us to believe that those proverbs in that set that don't mention the key words actually still are addressing that subject or issue. And that's how we understand the passages, or should do. And I'm going to begin with this 16th chapter and the first verse. There are 9 verses here that really are about submission to God, or God and man, what he does, what we do as believers. Or, if you like, 9 verses on the sovereignty of God in all departments of life. All the verses are to do with it. And as in some other sections, but not all of them, Solomon has helped us doubly by beginning and ending the section with a very similar proverb. So verse 1, the preparations of the heart in man and the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. And verse 9, a man's heart deviseth his way, but the Lord directeth his steps. And then after verse 9, the subject promptly changes, and constantly you're talking about the king for many verses. So it's clear that these 9 verses are all of a piece, and they're about wholehearted submission to God. And, dare I say it, it's deeply intelligent material. Of course it is, because it's the inspired word of God. And the topics, the subtopics dealt with, verse by verse, are immensely helpful to us. And they're all rather different, except in the case of 2 verses that develop the same idea. So, with that in mind, we can begin to look at them. First of all, verse 1. Now, this is about the God determines the outcome. So that would be our heading over verse 1. The preparations of the heart in man and the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. Now, it's quite clear that in this verse, our King James translators haven't helped us entirely, because they've lost the contrast in the verse. The preparations of the heart in man and the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. They've made it all of a piece. Now, another way of translating it, and obviously the correct way, because parallel verses put it this way, as I'll show you, is to say the preparations of the heart, that's man, in man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. There's a contrast there. Verse 9 echoes that verse. A man's heart deviseth his way, but the Lord directeth his steps. That closes the passage of 9 verses. And verse 1 is very similar. It makes a slightly different point, but it really should be constructed in exactly the same way. Now, this is about God determining the outcome. The preparations of the heart are of man. Man does that. The plans, the desires, the inclinations of the heart. And when Solomon uses the term heart here, he doesn't just mean the affections. He means the reason, the mind, the affections, and the will. All three aspects. The preparations of the heart, whether they're plans in the mind, desires in the heart, or sudden determinations of will. Well, we do all those things. We plan what we think we should do, what we would like to do. And these are big things that are in mind here, not small things to do with life's journey and life's direction. And we have our hopes and our plans. So we do that, yes. But the answer of the tongue, and this is not about speaking, there's not another speaking reference in all the 9 verses. So this is clearly used as a figure of speech. And the answer of the tongue, the decisive word, in other words, the command, what we will actually do, is from the Lord. So you see, it is very similar to verse 9. A man's heart deviseth his way, but the Lord directeth his steps. God determines the outcome. He makes the final decision. Well, you all know the famous words of Thomas A Kempis from his Of the Imitation of Christ. Man proposes, but God disposes. And although he doesn't use those words in the context of an exposition of these verses and similar verses in Proverbs, they clearly are. Man proposes, he plans, but God determines the outcome. God decides. Finally, what he will allow us to do, where he deflects us, and how. Which is all about submission to God. If that is so, then as believers, we wish to live in submission to God. It doesn't say, this verse, or other similar verses, it doesn't say, don't think, don't plan. It says, yes, plan, and think, and use initiative, and work things out and weigh the pros and cons and consider, but submit it to the Lord. Pray to him. Be yielded to him. Be ready to be deflected in any way. And this is the beginning, wholehearted submission to God. In all your plans, remember, God superintends the outcome always. In the unbeliever, well, he's in God's hands too. And God may allow him to prosper or do wicked things, all kinds of things. But ultimately, God will determine his end and his disappointments and his difficulties. He can't have it all his own way. And it's the same with the believer. We're under the discipline and care of the Lord always. So we submit to him. We don't feel that we're free agents and free to plan and have whatever we like. This is a great motive for holiness. If I pursue diligently and conscientiously improvement and holiness, sanctification before God, he will bless the outcome and he will guide. We see it in God frustrating us very often. Famous example would be John Newton and his 9 years trying, striving, and waiting patiently to get access into the ministry. He believed God had called him into ministry. He believed he was fitted for it. But he worked 9 years in the Liverpool area, largely as a tide surveyor, and other things completely unable to be received or given access or to be ordained into the church of those times. And yet, of course, he was submitted to God. He regarded it as his training period. He didn't know if, he didn't know when. But then eventually he was ordained, and he went to Olney and he in Bedfordshire, and there he exercised a long ministry. Do you remember his house and his rectory and the house in which William Cowper lived were back to back? And the famous Olney hymn book came out of that, and many other things. And then, unexpectedly to his amazement, he was called back down here to the city of London, to St. Mary's, Woolnoth, and that became one of the most influential pulpits in London. And he became the advisor and counsellor to Wilberforce and other members of the so-called Clapham sect group, members of the Church of England, the abolition of slavery, all those people in those days, and many others. And his writings were used in his, well, you know. But the first 9 years required his patience and submission. And because he had no idea that he would become the wise man among the evangelicals of Britain in his age, in his part of the century, but it was so, and God was preparing him with deep reading and many experiences. So the preparations of the heart in man, the plans are of man, and the answer of the tongue, the decision, what will actually happen, is from the Lord. So that introduces our thinking. And we go to verse 2, which deals with something quite different, and yet it's all about submission. And my heading for verse 2 would be this: self-evaluation is defective. We need to be submitted to God. Self-evaluation is deeply defective. All the ways of a man are clean in his own eyes, but the Lord weigheth the spirits. And there's a very similar verse in chapter 21 and verse 2 in a different context. Now, this is the fatal tendency of men and women, even believers, to justify ourselves. We self-justify constantly. We look at ourselves and our actions through rose-tinted spectacles constantly. Even godly people will have the same tendency. All the ways of a man are clean in his own eyes, but the Lord weigheth the spirits. The spirits are put for the inner person, the motives, the desires. The Lord weighs the inner person. Why weigheth? The Lord weighs. Well, I'll tell you what the picture is behind this. You're a farmer, and you take an animal or a bale of something to be sold in the marketplace, and they can see it's worth so much. Ha-ha, they don't trust you. They're very exact and precise about it. So out come the scales, and it's weighed, and you're paid by weights, as if you're not trusted. So the idea, the picture behind these words is, be careful. God is very exact. We gloss over our faults and our failings, but God is very precise, and he sees everything, and he weighs, and he misses not one wrong motive. All the ways of a man are clean in his own eyes, but the Lord doesn't just see, he weighs the spirits, the innermost being, and what you mean by things. We do not see our constant impatience and unreasonablenesses meted out to those around us. We don't notice them so much of the time. We don't notice our acts of thoughtlessness. we don't notice our proud times and moments. At least a lot of the time we don't notice. The power of habits. We form bad habits and we forget we've got them. We don't see them. So what's the moral of the proverb? It is this: submission to God every day. Ask him to show us what we really like, what we need to correct, what we should pay attention to. Give us lively consciences. Make us aware of the kind of people we are becoming or drifting into. We're dependent upon God. This is about submission to him in everything. We should submit to him in the great decisions. We should submit to him in self-examination and to his word. And when we read his word, one of the questions we ask is, what does this tell me about, this passage tell me about myself? In what way might it reprove me? Or in what way do I fall short? So remember, even for the godly, it's a fatal tendency not to notice, to justify we've reacted badly to something, and we spend the next 10 minutes telling ourselves, well, anyone would have done. We were justified in that. The provocation was extreme, and all the rest of it. It's human tendency to justify ourselves. So, for sanctification, we need the help of the Lord. That was the second verse. The third verse changes the subject slightly yet again, but it's about submission to God. Commit thy works unto the Lord, and thy thoughts shall be established. Now, if you've got a marginal reference, it will tell you that the word translated commit literally means roll your works on the Lord. So the idea is that your behaviour, your works day by day, are pictured as a burden. Roll them on the Lord. Roll thy works unto the Lord, and then your thoughts and your plans will be established, made stable, literally. The Hebrew there for established is set up, made to stand. So this is about, this section is about the Lord making our works stable by submission to him. Commit everything to the Lord. What a tragedy if we forget or we don't, and we never commit things to the Lord earnestly and pray everything to him and our daily works. Only then will our plans be established and permanent. Let me give you an illustration of this institutionally. There was in London here, not so many years ago, North London at any rate, an exceptionally large congregation in the last century. And it was stable and large for many years. But then, when the pastor retired, it kind of collapsed in its doctrinal stand, and surprisingly rapidly. There was a pastor there for about 7-8 years, and just things seemed to hold on, and then everything went wild. And a Reformed church became a charismatic church. And solid Reformed doctrine was thrown away. And things deteriorated and crazy practices came in. Within 10 years, the stand of, 30 years was gone. How could such a congregation be unstable? Makes you think of us. Will we be unstable in the coming years as things change and pastors and elders and deacons grow old and pass away? Will things rapidly change? Will the people think, we're tired of one stand, we'll go off to in another direction and we'll go the opposite way and become completely the opposite kind of church, with absolutely contrary doctrines and practices. It's rather frightening. Could it happen? Well, it happened in the church I have in mind, because everything was not rolled upon the Lord. The preaching may have been tremendous, but the church behind it was never really conducted on properly biblical lines, and there wasn't care taken on the kind of people who were brought in to membership, and there wasn't care taken in the spirit of the pastoral epistles on the qualities of the people who were appointed to office. There wasn't care taken. It wasn't a working church. The people were not putting their hand to the plough, applying their faith, serving the Lord. A lot of components of the New Testament church and its life were missing. So you see, this verse applied institutionally. That church, though it was no doubt good and blessed in its way, did not really roll its works upon the Lord and conform everything to Scripture and submit it to Him. So they didn't teach terrible things or do terrible things, but it didn't have stability. Commit thy works unto the Lord, and thy thoughts, your plans and intentions will stand and be established. Now contrast that with this church in the time of C.H. Spurgeon, who died in 1892, and the church was vast and had a clear stand. Well, that stand continued, and apart from a blip when a gentleman from Chicago named A.C. Dixon was pastor for about 8 years, who didn't really fit entirely the stand of the church, but nevertheless he was a man of dignity and solemnity in his conduct of services, even if there were tensions during his pastorate, this is many years ago. The church, after he went right back to its tradition, and it held it pretty well until after World War II. That's years and years and years. That's decades, 5-6 decades of absolute stability. And then the church took some wrong steps, and the ministry never ceased to be evangelical, but it did cease to be wholly reformed. And the church even rejoined the Baptist Union. Yes, but still it stood, because when my wife and I came in 1970, even though after the war things had diminished greatly and there were very few people left, the dear old souls who were here in 1970 sustained a reform ministry. Many of them were solidly reformed in their outlook, and they wanted eagerly to go right back to the old ways. What a picture, because back in Spurgeon's time, the work was rolled upon the Lord. It was made stable. It stood. And that's the promise here. Commit thy works unto the Lord, and thy thoughts, your plans, your contrivances, in effect as the Hebrew, shall be established. I could tell you the same, but it's not a happy story, about a Bible college, really in comparatively recent times in this country, that had a history of being reformed and stable and good. But then the leaders of that Bible college got a fancy idea. The college was short of money. The college needed to be able to make progress. But instead of rolling the burden on the Lord, let's gather together in prayer. We'll keep our principles. We'll pursue things as we've always done and honour the Lord. But let's come prayerfully for a resolution of our difficulties. Instead of that, they had a brilliant idea, a way of solving the problem with earthly wisdom. It so happened they had a student from another country who came from a big mega church in that other country. It didn't hold the same values, the same principles, but through this student, the idea blossomed, oh, they would get this mega church far away, which was looking to do something in England, to sponsor them. And so they opened negotiations, and so it went forward. The mega church from overseas built them a new facility, poured in money so that they could hire what they hoped would be world-class lecturing staff, took the majority of places on the governing board, and oh, what a brilliant solution. We've got the money, we've got the facilities, we've, from our brilliant human plans. You know how long it lasted? A couple of years. And now that Bible college is completely progressive in its outlook and in its teaching. Its old values have gone. What's left of them is quickly being eroded away. The old principal and so on, who endorsed the foolish move, he's been sent packing. There wasn't any stability in the plan. A brilliant whiz-bang human plan instead of prayer meetings and rolling your burden upon the Lord. Now, I'm giving it institutional examples, but it applies in our lives. Are your career aspirations absorbing too much time and energy? Things even that are important, home and family, absorbing everything, and you're not rolling your works upon the Lord and living in submission to Him, well, then your life won't be stable, and you won't have instrumentality and blessing. You won't have this thing, what you do, and your works won't stand any more than Christian institutions that decide clever plans are better than prayer and dependence upon the Lord. So these verses are profound. Let's go to verse 4. I don't want to cover too much ground, but here is God controls the wicked. Submit yourself to Him. He controls even the wicked. The Lord hath made all things for Himself, yea, even the wicked, for the day of evil, which is the day of calamity, or the day of distress. Well, you see this in Exodus chapter 9, verse 16, where God tells Pharaoh that He's raised him up in order that he can be made an example of as a rebel against God, and the people of God can be delivered from his tyranny, so that God can demonstrate to his people his great love and his saving power. And that's what this means. That God has made, in a sense, even the wicked for days of evil, like the deliverance of the children of Israel from bondage in Egypt. Pharaoh was raised up for that, and the Apostle Paul is inspired to take that up, as you know, in Romans 9 and verse 17, and he quotes Exodus. It's all for his purposes, like persecution. God raises up people who persecute the church for his glory, so that he can demonstrate his care of his people and his kindness to them in all circumstances, and ultimately his deliverance. God raises up even wicked leaders so that it's demonstrated to all that the fallen human race, man in his weakness, cannot succeed in perfecting his countries and keeping order and happiness around the world. Man can't do it. Even the wicked demonstrate these things and make them clear. And ultimately, they are raised up so that God shall be glorified in the day of judgment. What has this got to do with believers? Well, it's a great comfort to us and an incentive to us always to know that even the wicked, they don't know it, but ultimately serve the glory of God in some way or other. We should be entirely submitted to Him. That's the fourth verse. Look at verse 5. What a challenging verse this is. Everyone that is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. That means is disgusting in the sight of God. Everyone that is proud in heart disgusts the Lord. Though hand join in hand, try and read it without the italics, which are put there by our translators to help us out. They don't always do so. Hand in hand, he shall not be unpunished. The Hebrew says, he shall not be innocent. Hand in hand, though hand join in hand, suggests people getting together. You leave the italics out. Hand in hand suggests something quite different, that someone's doing whatever he's doing with all his might and main. Like the tennis player who plays a shot with both hands. Like any of us who brings our other hand into play whenever we need more power or more strength to do something. And I think that is the figure that's used here. Though hand in hand, you do everything two-handed. You do it with your utmost strength. You won't succeed in anything spiritual or good with pride. Everyone that is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Hand in hand, he is not innocent. So submission to God. Pride is the opposite of submission to God. I submit to God because he knows. And I am feeble and inadequate. So I roll my works upon him. That's how we should think. But if we don't need to do that, if we're overconfident, if we're self-reliant, if we don't seek his help, well, that's pride. Have you gone weeks, possibly, dear friend, without praying for help? You may not have realized it, but that's a form of pride. And to go days or weeks without praying for help is disgusting to God, because you're exhibiting to him an attitude, I can cope. I don't need you. I don't need help. Submission to God does away with pride. It's very relevant. It's necessary in this passage about submission to God. Everyone that is proud in heart, what an enemy to us pride is. We're not blameless. Always submit. You remember what the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians and chapter 9 and in verse 27. Well, I read it from verse 26. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway, reprobate, discarded for Christian service. And pride will accomplish that. So we're frightened of pride. Then I come down to verse 6. Submission fears God. Something I've notice that in some circles, some Christian circles, there's a lot of singing about the cross, and that's good, but things go out of balance because people rejoice in God's provisions and God's forgiving love, but it's all too jolly and happy. There's no fear alongside it. You notice here in the book of Proverbs, fear comes in. By mercy and truth, iniquity is purged. That's atonement. I'll come back to that. And by the fear of the Lord, men depart from evil. In Proverbs 16:6, gratitude for mercy is alongside fear of the Lord. They both go together. Our hearts are warmed. Our spirits are lifted up we rejoice in Calvary, the forgiveness of sin, free salvation. These are wonderful things, but we must keep the fear of the Lord alongside it, otherwise there won't be holiness. By mercy and truth, this is Psalm 85, verse 10. Mercy and truth have met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed each other. That's Calvary, where God's love and God's justice were both honoured by the death of Christ, bearing away the punishment of sin. The two irreconcilables, God's great love and mercy, but it couldn't be exercised because of God's justice, would demand the punishment of sin. So Christ bore the punishment of sin, and God was free to pour forth his mercy and his love. It's the same thought here in Proverbs 16:6. By mercy and truth, the truth of God's justice, iniquity is purged. And the word translated purged in the original means atoned for, because it's covered. By mercy and truth, iniquity is covered, atoned for. And right alongside it, by the fear of the Lord, men depart from evil. So we fear him. We fear his displeasure. We fear his discipline. If there's no fear of God, it's more than a deep respect. It's a fear because of his holiness. We rejoice in his goodness and his kindness, his love. But he is holy, and we fear his discipline. If there's no fear, well then, you can't depart from evil. You're not concerned about sin. You don't have a real view of God. No need of him. So in the Submission to God series of Proverbs, by mercy and truth, iniquity is atoned for, and by fear of the Lord, men depart from evil. Keep up your fear and your high regard of him and your fear of offending him. That's vital. Now hurry down to verse 7. When a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. This is about the overruling of enemies. Our enemies are the world, the flesh, and the devil. If we're submitted to God, then even our enemies will be at peace with us. Not all the time. Persecutors. We've been reading on to the young on House Party Conference at least a chapter from Pastor Korev's book, Letters from a Soviet Prison Camp, and on Berean Retreat. And you see the story of Pastor Korev. He's gone to glory now, spent many years in Soviet prisons, and yet, though he suffered terribly, there were long periods of time when they respected him. Both staff and fellow inmates, they respected him. And he was able to speak and to preach to them. So it was true. God overruled. And the times of liberty to speak to great groups of prisoners lasted longer than the times of suffering and more intense persecution. And in part of Korev's experience, the gaps between his imprisonments were times of amazing fruitfulness in the old Soviet Union, and visiting of churches, and God moving in almost awakening proportions to the conversion of souls, and nobody molesting him, nobody interfering with him. And so he was able to say that he proved the truth of this proverb, that if you serve the Lord with all your heart, God makes even your enemies be at peace with you. And there'll be times when they afflict you, and there'll be even longer times when they leave you alone. That's a marvellous thing. Well, it's not only in times of persecution, but our enemies are the world, the flesh, and the devil. And you submit yourself to God, you'll have much less temptation from the allurements of this passing world. You'll lose all your taste for it. And even the enemy of souls, his attempts to cast doubts into your mind and to drag you down and make you doubt your conversion or doubt the faith, will be less and less if you're truly committed and submitted to the Lord. So you see, these are all aspects of submission to God. And the fruits is really too much for us in a single study. Look at verse 8. Better, you think, our pastor, this is out of place. Verse 8, this proverb surely doesn't fit the subject at all. Can't see any way you can get to submission to God in that. Better is a little with righteousness than great revenues without right. Well, you see, the point is, this is about submission bringing you security. Better is a little with righteousness. Ideally, it means right, as in the second case at the end of verse 8. It's a judicial declaration. Better is a little with a judicial declaration than great revenues without a judicial declaration. What it means is this: it's about a title deed. It's about a right to property. Better is a little. You're not rich, but you've got your property, your little small holding, and it's yours, and your family and you are secure. It's stable. Far better than great revenues. Somebody, somehow, has come by great estates and tracts of land, but they don't belong to him. And he lets them out and he's making money hand over fist. But they're not strictly his. He's either a squatter or he's on a very short lease, and he can be turfed out and left with nothing at any moment. That's the idea here. Far better to be a believer with little and a freehold than it is to have great revenues and none of it is actually yours. And the idea behind it is this. The Apostle Paul say, as far as we know, he had no home. He lived as a poor man. He went from place to place with the minimum. He never enriched himself. He could have done so. Thousands upon thousands of people appreciated him. But he never did so. He went around and he was wholly committed to the Lord. But how stable was his situation and his work. And look at the privileges he had. He was able to preach to kings, to rulers. He wrote letters even from prison. I wonder if he knew it at the time. He knew they were inspired, but I wonder if he knew that they would be the backbone of the New Testament for at least 2,000 years. Amazing, the stability, what was set and established, like a poor man with a freehold. And there have been many, many rich who've been swept away and left nothing behind them. Better is a little with right, with that protection of God and that freehold in heaven and stability for what they do, than great revenues without right. The two halves of the Proverbs agree. And then finally, and I'm over time, verse 9, a man's heart deviseth his way, and Solomon sums up his series just as he began it, but the Lord directeth his steps. Steps, the unexpected things that happen Christians submitted to God in their lives. So we've looked quickly at submission to God, because God determines the outcome. Verse 1. Verse 2. Self-evaluation is defective. Be submitted to God to see who you really are. Verse 3. Roll your works upon the Lord. Verse 4. God controls the wicked. Verse 5. Pride is a challenge to God and offensive to him. Verse 6. Submission fears God. Verse 7. God curbs your enemies and gives you peace. Verse 8, submission brings security. And verse 9 sums it up. Submission keeps you in God's purpose. So they're really all about that same topic or theme. And that's our devotional study for this evening. Dear friends, the book of Proverbs is just too profound for us. Let's close singing hymn 458. Hymn number 400.